follower of Rand getting the White House, because I can't imagine Americans electing an atheist as president.
Well, that is not a... She does not consider that an important part of her view. The important is the positive. She rejects not only God, but many, many different versions, from poltergeists to gremlins. From her point of view, what counts is what are you for. But I grant you, she would never be elected. First of all, she was born in Russia, so she's not...
No, she's not. She can't be a candidate, can she?
But I don't think anybody can get elected with decent views in today's philosophic state of the world. First, you need a philosophic revolution, and after that, saving the world will be easy. But without it, it's hopeless.
Leonard, is it an apocryphal story that she had a dollar sign on her coffin?
It's true, but it wasn't by her doing. And in fact, it was more or less by mine, in the sense...
Leonard, you had it put there.
No, I didn't, but I allowed it to be wheeled in. Some florist set it at the behest of a fan, and it was a gigantic 6-foot dollar sign, and I wasn't too secure in my tenure, and I was prevailed on by various people, oh, let's let it in. And then, of course, it got all the press coverage, but she had nothing to do with that. I wouldn't let it in today.
I must tell you that these days in Australia, because of the power of Los Angelian culture and American culture, most Australians are buried under the sign of the Golden Arches. Look, thanks very much for that, Malcolm Fraser, former Prime Minister of Australia, Joan Kennedy Taylor, feminist and Vice President of the Feminist for Free Expression Movement and co-chair of their legal committee, and Leonard Peikoff, Leonard being Ayn Rand's, Ayn Rand's intellectual heir, and of course a fellow broadcaster. I've enjoyed talking with you very much.
This is LNL's Summer Season on Radio National. listener from the beginning of two books which appeared last year. The first from Robin Davidson's Desert Places. They cannot scare me with their empty spaces between stars, on stars, where no human race is. I have it in me so much nearer home to scare myself with my own desert places. And this from Dante's Inferno is quoted by Robert Desai in Night Letters. A bitter place. Death could scarce be bitterer. But if I would show the good that came of it, I must talk about things other than the good. Now, both these writers, Robin and Robert, have spent many a day reflecting on the meaning of solitude, its bearing on being in a foreign place, and how to travel through that place, coping with the mystery of other languages, other cultures. Their most recent books are very different. One is a travelogue, Desert Places, by Robin. The other, a novel, Night Letters, by Robert. Yet these reoccurring themes of solitude, travel, and the business of writing seem essential to understanding not only another place, but themselves. Now, I asked Robert to say first what all this business of travelling through and beside other cultures was about for him. Did he aspire to loneliness?
Not exactly, Philip. It's really about finding company, I suppose, in some sort of way. It's about trying to find ways into intimacy, even though I might be in a very foreign place to me. But of course, the places that I was in were not deserts in any sense of the word. They're very different sorts of places from the ones that Robin wrote about.
Robin, is there a difference between solitude and loneliness? Do we tend to confuse them?
Yes, I think we do. I think, like Robert, I've had quite enough of solitude, I think. The lovely passage in his book, which made me laugh. Yes, I think loneliness is solitude that's forced upon you. When you choose to be alone, when you need it, and when it's nourishing to you, then that's a chosen solitude and a jolly good thing. But I think particularly in our culture, the people are separated from each other. Intimacy requires a lot of effort, a lot of work. And yes, I think loneliness is one of the blights of our particular kind of individualism, our particular kind of culture.
Well, Robert, I'm sure that's right. In fact, surely the value of solitude is becoming lost in the modern world. We're all so desperately busy.
Desperately busy trying not to be lonely and sort of losing the capacity for true solitude, I think.
Robert?
Yes, well, you see, I think that we try to counteract loneliness, well, many of us do, in the wrong way. We think that we can stop being lonely if only we might be companioned by somebody. And, of course, in Robin's case, she had people all over the place. I mean, the problem was...
And a lot of camels, too.
The crowd, and a lot of camels and all sorts of other
Robin
animals.
Robin has fixated on camels.
No, I haven't. I deny.
Oh, come on, Robin, you've been watching camels for decades.
No, it's just that if you hang out in deserts, you're bound to come across them.
Yes. Well, Robin, your journey with the Rajasthani desert folk was anything but a romantic experience, wasn't it? It's, you finished up detesting much of it.
I think it marked the end of romanticism for me. I mean, capital R romanticism. You know, it's just hell out there, really. Which isn't to say that they're not remarkable people. And I formed quite deep bonds with them and have tremendous respect for them, but I don't think their lifestyle is romantic at all. It's just bloody hard.
Well, you also raise another issue, solitude, loneliness, and the third thing, privacy. Now, privacy was unavailable to you entirely, wasn't it?
Yes. I think this underscored the whole notion of the difference between loneliness and solitude. I mean, for Indian people, being alone is a freakish state. You know, every individual is fundamentally a part of a group. So they simply could not understand my need to be alone sometimes, you know, just any time, like going to the loo. So
do you go to the loo on your own?
It was the worst...
How eccentric. Do you go to the loo on your own?
Yeah. Childhood.
You've changed since you've gone to England, I don't know.
How do you know?
So that was even something as fundamental as that couldn't be understood.
Couldn't be understood. And I think also a deep curiosity about this strange white creature, because, you know, I was out there in the bush and most people hadn't seen a European, and So curiosity was also very much part of it. But it was the worst of all possible combinations, that is, the isolation of not being able to communicate, because I couldn't speak the language, coupled with never being alone, never being able to go inside myself.
And you also experienced quite excruciating boredom, didn't you?
Terrible boredom. Oh. Yes, because I was thrown back completely on my own resources. And I had thought, previous to that trip, that I had pretty strong inner resources. But it did make me understand that that length of time thrown back on your own inner world, with really nothing to pull you out of that, nothing to connect you to the world as it is, it's torture.
This was a completely different experience for you, wasn't it, from the ones you had in Australia?
Yes. Well, you see, in Australia it was chosen solitude. I very much wanted and needed to be on my own. And in that sense it was a very nourishing experience for me, whereas the Indian one was perhaps nourishing in a different sense, but just terribly, terribly hard.
Robert, how do you use solitude, or rather, how should it be used? What is the great creative gain that can come from having it?
Well, for me at least, it has something to do with language. I mean, it interested me very much in Robin's book that she wanted language. She wanted actually the English language to come and be her companion. And she suffered as much as anything from the lack of the English language. What happens to me in solitude, and I don't feel threatened because I'm not in an extreme situation, is that I experiment with voices and with language. I actually talk to myself quite a lot. I mean, I don't know if I can coax you, Philip, into admitting whether you do
it. I do it all the time.
Oh, do you?
I drive immense distances every week, and I have long chats with myself.
Yes, I've seen drivers who do that. I tend not to do it in public, I must say. But I try out different voices. If I've just been watching the bill, I might go and interrogate myself, for example. And
really?
See what I might say. I mean,
do you have fights with yourself as well? Do you have arguments? Battles?
Yes, but that's quite threatening, don't you find?
What's
that?
I just said, and if so, who wins? Do you, Robin? Did you find talking to yourself a helpful strategy?
Well, I think I just do it automatically. I don't even think of it as neurotic anymore. I just have these
aloud,
wildly interesting conversations. Yeah, sure. We've all got at least 10,000 characters living inside us, haven't we?
That's right.
Robert, you say that you're not in an extreme situation. Do you really believe that? You're facing a mortal illness, for heaven's sake.
Well, everyone is facing, I suppose, mortality in some sort of way. No, I feel actually exceptionally companioned. What I tried to do in my book, I suppose, was show ways that I think your solitude can be tempered. I mean, I do think that solitude, the very word, the sort of Latinate word, is a class sort of thing. If you're working class, if you're a single mum with 5 children under 10 and no visible means of support, you're actually alone. You're by yourself. You're abandoned, deserted. If you're middle class, like me, with a choice, then it's solitude that you enjoy. I think that, you know, the words give away a lot there. Now, I tried to temper it, and through friendship in particular, not being married, friendship is very, very important to me. Different kinds of friends, nurturing friendships. I rely on friendship for all the most important things, really.
Robin, you had too much friendship in your desert places, didn't you? You wanted a partner, which was unavailable.
No, I don't think that's right. I mean, I did want to sort of disappear from time to time in order to get myself back together, you know, to sort out my own head. But no, I think quite the opposite, that I want connectedness. I want to understand what that consciousness is across from me. You know, the point of being with the Rabari was to do with a profound interest in other consciousness and how we connect with each other and in what ways we assimilate to each other and, you know, what it really means to be human. And we can't find out what it really means to be human unless we're connected to other humans, unless we're part of a dialogue.
It's interesting what a different impression you've brought out of the desert to, say, T. Lawrence's writings on the same subject. Did you go back and have a look at Lawrence?
I haven't. And, you see, I suppose I'm not... Well, perhaps I am, and I'm being disingenuous, I don't know. I'm not particularly, or any more, aware of the importance of the symbolism of deserts for me. Perhaps I was with tracks. I think that was about going into the wastes and sort of proving, you know, proving oneself. Whereas with the India book, it was very much about a curiosity to do with wandering, with what nomadism means, the effect it has on... the way people are with each other and how they perceive themselves in the world. So it was a much more to do with connecting with human beings than going off into the desert and being sort of purified by the wastes.
Robin, there's a conflict, I think, between the photographs and the text. The text persuades me totally to your point of view. But when I look at the photographs of these radiant, glowing, happy, zestful people, you know, where the hell do they come from?
I couldn't agree more. I didn't want there to be photos in the text at all, but of course one gets bullied by publishers. And I think that...
So your advice would be to the reader to rip them out. Rip out the photographs and play with it.
Well, enjoy the photographs, but don't think that they have anything to do really with reality. I mean, it tells us a lot about photography, I think.
Yeah.
Can I come in here?
Yeah.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I think the very interesting thing that you bring out in your book, which is almost unavailable to people like me, is that sense of belonging to a whole tradition, not just to the visible family, but to this long tradition that rescues those people in Rajasthan from any sort of sense of isolation at all. That's where I think we suffer, people of my generation, who have very little sense of anything going back beyond, well, your own birth, I suppose.
But you invent them, don't
I do
you?
Too.
Robert, you've spent a lot of time inventing these things in your
fiction. I suppose, you know, as a literary person, I have to sort of say, well, actually, my ancestors are Gogol or Dante or Lawrence Stone or whoever they are, because that's all I've got available to me.
Yes.
Because all that...
Do you think, Robert... Sorry, go on.
No, please.
I was going to say, do you think it makes a difference being adopted?
Well, it would be romantic
One's...
It would be romantic to think so, but I wonder, really, if that can be true. Mm. I mean, I had a very happy childhood, actually, and felt very included. I really am talking more about what's happened to our sense of who we are at the end of this century, where no one seems to want to know about history, or everyone wants to be an individual. Nobody has any very strong sense of even what it means to be Australian, I suppose. Whereas those Rika people that you're talking about, they are placed absolutely in the cosmos. They know they're a web.
Well, this raises the issue of religion, which plays a role in both books. Robin, you were able to observe Hinduism in action too. Did the theology impress you in the context, or were you disappointed by it?
Well, always the answer to that is yes and no. You know, there, as you know, what's happening in India at the moment is pretty terrifying in terms of the growth of fundamentalism and so on. On the other hand, you see these people, as Robert was saying, so certain of who they are in the cosmos. You know, their ancestors go back, the sense that their children will go forward, they're sort of placed in the universe. They're not lost in the way that we are lost.
Well, that sounds quite an enviable state, Robin.
Well, it is, I think, you know, and here we are in this century, we've not just lost God. We sort of lost each other, and I think there are very good things to be said about that as well. You know, it forces us to be pretty tough-minded, I think, and to find meaning in life without relying on fantasies, I suppose. And as you know, as Robert said, I think most of us these days find that sort of meaning in art, various forms of art.
Well, Robert, you also looked at religion, in particular at Catholicism, in your travels. How important is Catholicism to you in this stage in your life?
Well, Catholicism isn't important in itself to me at all. I mean, I don't have a Catholic background, but I'm interested in people who... I'm interested in Christianity, I must say, simply because I think it's good to start from where you are. It doesn't seem to work for me just to throw things out the way you can when you're 18 and look around and sort of feel, oh, I've got a clean slate, I can recreate the world as I will. It's better for me to take what I've got and work outwards from that. And of course, being an Australian, what I've got really is Christianity, and Catholicism as such isn't my bag at all.
Well, you've also, as well as the good book, you've also got Alice in Wonderland, and you use that as a metaphor to describe the shifting of realities and your journey through those changes. Oh, that's Robin, I'm sorry. Robin?
Sorry, say that again?
I'm saying you use Alice in Wonderland as a metaphor.
Yes. Well, I think that was more a metaphor for being utterly alien in this place that I couldn't fathom. You know, I felt like Alice in Wonderland. That I was just in a place I couldn't understand even remotely, doing these things that felt very, very peculiar.
Did that make you more intensely yourself, Robin, or did you start to sort of crumble? Did it make you feel...
I think it certainly made me crumble. I think the third part of the final third of the book is essentially about somebody crumbling, sort of imploding.
I love the way you fetishized the telephone, actually. The way that the telephone started to become the centre of the universe. I think all of us who've been lonely know that feeling. It's the telephone that is going to connect you to
reality. But think of this, she was away from the fax machine. You didn't fetishise the fax machine.
It's that the phrase I used in the book was homesickness for language. You know, you just can't really live without it. It's like a sort of trimming device. It keeps you plugged into being sane, really. And when those points of orientation go, then you indeed become disoriented, sort of adrift. And well, plus, you know, of course, it was also just very, everything was difficult as well as that. I was ill and I was tired, and so everything sort of turned it into a bit of a nightmare.
Robin Davidson's book, Desert Places, published by Viking. Robert Desay's book, Night Letters, published by Macmillan. Now, on the next edition of LNL's summer series, we'll be discussing the burning of black churches, which last year was a very popular pastime for some in the south of America, and we'll be taking another look at Iranian culture. See you then.
Democracy suffer when the law tries to think global and act local? Hi, Susanna Lobez here. This week, with former Chief Justice Sir Anthony Mason, the Law Report explores the internationalisation of our law. Is playing in the big league taking the ball out of our hands? And treaty making, was it just too secretive? And can it be democratic?
To find out, join Susanna Lobez tomorrow morning at 8:30 or tomorrow night following the news at 8.
Radio National 846.
ABC News with John Greaves. Five people rescued from a capsized pleasure boat about 19 nautical miles off the Pilbara coast are back on dry land. Police say the four men and a 9-year-old boy were sighted by a chartered State Emergency Service aircraft clinging to the side of their 5-metre fiberglass cabin cruiser. The crew from the sea search and rescue boat Gunmetal pulled them from the sea a few hours later after their position had been pinpointed by a search aircraft. They'd been reported missing since yesterday evening after failing to return from a fishing trip. Police say the five are in good spirits after their ordeal and appear to be in good health. There's been another happy ending in the Pilbara with the rescue of a family of four from a swollen river crossing. The man and woman and their two sons, aged 6 and 10, were swept into the flooded Shaw River southeast of Port Hedland when they attempted a crossing in their vehicle on the Marble Bar Road. A helicopter was sent to the scene, and its pilot, Bill Tucker, says the only sad note for the family after the rescue was the loss of their dog. But even that turned out well.
The dog that we couldn't save was washed downstream, and I did hear from the search and rescue guys in Brisbane after I got back here that he'd turned up on the riverbank, so everybody's united and everybody's okay.
Voting's underway in Chechnya to choose a president and parliament following last year's agreement, which ended the 21 months of fighting between Chechen separatists and Russian troops. The BBC's Andrew Harding reports from the Chechen capital Grozny that voter turnout's been brisk.
There's an almost carnival atmosphere at some polling stations here in Grozny. After all the chaos and violence of the past few years, people have embraced these elections with enormous enthusiasm. Many people seem to feel that Chechnya's former military commander, Aslan Maskhadov, is the best man for the job. The one issue which has dominated these elections is the question of Chechnya's status. All the leading candidates have vowed to make the republic fully independent, despite Russian objections. Voters seem to agree. These elections may well take Chechnya one step further towards political independence. Economically, though, the republic is in no position to stand alone. Its economy has been devastated by the war, and it remains almost totally dependent on Russia for survival.
The Premier of Bougainville is appealing to the Australian government to keep Radio Australia alive. Sean Dorney reports that the Premier says the people in his war-ravaged province rely on the ABC's overseas service to keep themselves in touch with what's going on both in the wider world and on their island.
The Bougainville Premier, Gerard Sonato, says most Bougainvillians learnt of the assassination of his predecessor, Theodore Miryung, last October by listening to Radio Australia, which carried my reports of his shooting within 24 hours of his death. Mr. Sonato says Bougainvillians tune in to RA for the latest information. He says the Australian government should realise what an important service Radio Australia provides to the people of the Asia-Pacific region and not accept the Mansfield Report recommendation that it be sacrificed to save money. Sean Dorney, Port Moresby.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he's confident of delivering his people on the Palestinian question. Ross Dunn reports from Jerusalem that Mr. Netanyahu said he can complete the task without a referendum or a national unity government.
Mr. Netanyahu says he will defy his critics by unveiling a clear plan for a final settlement with the Palestinians. While refusing to disclose details of the offer, he says it will fall short of the sovereign state they are demanding. He says a future Palestinian homeland must not have its own army, which could threaten Israel's survival. Mr. Netanyahu claims that a majority of Israelis will support him over this issue. Ross Dunn, Jerusalem.
Hundreds of Indonesian street hawkers have rioted in the capital, Jakarta, after authorities tried to stop them from plying their trade. Police say the traders rioted after authorities intervened during selling at the busy market in central Jakarta. The rioters burnt a government building and 6 official vehicles. Footpath selling in Jakarta is technically illegal, but is common, despite frequent attempts by authorities to enforce the law. German prosecutors say they're still investigating tennis star Steffi Graf, whose father was found guilty last week of evading millions of dollars in tax on her earnings. Mannheim prosecutor Hubert Jobski says investigators hope to include the case as soon as they can. Last week, the judge who sentenced Graf's father recommended the continuing investigation against Steffi should be dropped. But Mr. Jobski says the judge's recommendation have no bearing on their inquiry, adding that he wouldn't like to speculate about the outcome of the investigation. And in cricket, Australia will be looking to secure a quick victory tomorrow in the fourth test of the Adelaide Oval, ensuring a series win and the retention of the Frank Worrell Trophy. This is ABC News.
Radio National, 846. Does democracy suffer when the law tries to think global and act local? Hi, Susanna Lobez here. This week, with former Chief Justice Sir Anthony Mason, the Law Report explores the internationalisation of...
his attempt simply to wait until the protest runs out of energy without giving any real concessions. However, the Serbian opposition say President Milosevic is himself growing impatient. The riot police have become much more willing to use their batons against demonstrators, and the opposition fear it's only a matter of days before the street protest is crushed.
The United Nations Environment Programme says the global environment is worsening as interest in the problem apparently wanes. A summary presented to the Nairobi-based programme Governing Council says in the Asia-Pacific, two-thirds of the region's population live in absolute poverty despite high economic growth. It says 19 of the 25 nations with the highest percentage of people without access to safe drinking water are in Africa. The report says many of Europe's environmental problems stem from high consumption of resources and output of waste in densely populated areas. ABC News.
Radio National 846.
Does democracy suffer when the law tries to think global and act local? Hi, Susanna Lobez here. This week, with former Chief Justice Sir Anthony Mason, the Law Report explores the internationalisation of our law. Is playing in the big league taking the ball out of our hands? And treaty making, was it just too secretive? And can it be democratic?
To find out, join Susanna Lobez tomorrow morning at 8:30 or tomorrow night following the news at 8.
His 37 children make sandcastles. Johann Sebastian is conducting our orchestra wearing baggy shorts and thongs, and I'm covered in half an inch of pink zinc because this, dear listener, is yet another edition of the LNL summer season. Now, what are we doing tonight? A little later in the program, we'll go in search of solitude and discover the pleasures of solitary travelling with Robin Davidson and Robert Desai. But first, we're going to go in search of the virtues of selfishness as we explore the life and work of political philosopher Ayn Rand. Now, political philosophers don't usually attract huge crowds or media attention, but that was not true of Ayn Rand. When she died in 1982, hundreds and hundreds stood in line outside the funeral parlour on a cold winter's night, just a file past her open coffin. I suspect some of them were there, however, to make sure she was dead. She was, of course, both a writer and a philosopher. Her novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, have sold millions. And her non-fiction books, like The Virtue of Selfishness, laid the bases of political philosophy, which is still influential today. Ronald Reagan, of course, claimed her as an inspiration. Alan Greenspan, the current chairman of the Fed, America's Federal Reserve Bank, was one of her many disciples. And her own Malcolm Fraser claims to have tried to implement her ideas during his time as PM. So who was Ayn Rand, and what is it about her ideas and her writing that has attracted and continues to attract so many? Why is her influence as strong today as when she died? Now, to discuss Ayn Rand and her influence, we brought together Leonard Peikoff, billed as her intellectual heir. He's a doctor of philosophy and knew Ayn Rand for 31 years. We also spoke to Joan Kennedy Taylor, a feminist and the vice president of the Feminists for Free Expression. And last but not least, we spoke to our own Malcolm Fraser, former PM and Ayn Rand acolyte. Now, Leonard began by giving us a brief introduction to Rand's ideas.
Well, the best way I can do it is to say that she has four essential positions in the four main branches of philosophy. In metaphysics, she believes that reality exists, it is what it is, independent of the content of the human mind. She denies that there's a supernatural world, and she denies any form of nihilism or subjectivism, that is, the idea that it's all a matter of opinion, there is no external fact. In theory of knowledge, or epistemology, she holds that the only means of knowing reality is sensory evidence based on direct observation, and then logic or rational thought derived from sensory observation. So she rejects all forms of mysticism or emotionalism. everything basically has to be approached scientifically and logically. In ethics, which is how you should live, she holds that the standard is man's life, and that the proper code of ethics is rational self-interest, each man living by his own mind, for his own sake, neither sacrificing himself to others nor others to himself, but living by his own productive effort and trading with others to mutual advantage when they both agree. And the political expression of that is complete laissez-faire capitalism, which means the complete separation of state and economics. No welfare, no government interference in the economy, the government solely as a policeman, foreign and domestic, to protect the individual from having his rights violated by force or fraud. That's the briefest. Did I come in under 2 minutes?
Leonard, that was a splendid quintessential performance. How influenced were her ideas by her turbulent childhood in Russia?
Only in reverse. She hated Russia virtually from the time that she became conscious. She hated the mysticism and the statism. She grew up under the Tsar. She briefly saw the revolution, and then she saw communism. In fact, the communist revolution took place under her window, started in St. Petersburg, and she wanted one thing out of Russia, and that was to get out.
Simple as that. She became quite obsessed with American culture, did she not, whilst in Russia?
Yes. First of all, Western European culture, and then because she loved Viennese operetta, and then American movies. And she actually, when she first left Russia, she went directly to Hollywood, almost directly, and got a job with Cecil B. DeMille as an extra and a screenwriter for The Silent Screen.
I didn't know that. That's simply marvelous. Now, how did you get to know Leonard, and what was it about her and her ideas that attracted you?
I met her as a teenager. I was in pre-med up in Canada, where I'm from originally. I met her through a mutual friend, and in the course of one evening's discussion, she was living in Southern California at the time, she convinced me that there are objective answers to philosophic questions, and that those answers are life and death, because philosophy is what moves the world. And I went out of there after an evening thinking, what am I doing in medicine when everything that counts is in philosophy? And I pretty quickly changed my major, moved to the United States, and became successively her student, associate, and heir.
And you knew her for what, 30-odd years?
31 years.
Now, Joan, with you it was almost like St. Joan hearing her voices, because her influence on you was quite dramatic, in that you came from a democratic liberal background.
Well, it wasn't a very activist democratic liberal background, but the community in which I was raised pretty much thought of democratic liberalism as the substructure of what was going on in the world. But when I read Atlas Shrugged, I read it over the course of a weekend, and it's the only time I've had the experience of waking myself up in the morning to get back to reading a book. And I was enormously excited by the questions that he raised in my mind, and that Atlas Shrugged raised in my mind, about what I had assumed about the world, politics, capitalism, if you like, the whole economic world, which I knew very little about.
Malcolm Fraser, did you also have the same sort of dramatic introduction to Rand's writings?
No, I didn't think quite so dramatic. It was The Fountainhead. It was Atlas Shrugged. As a book I loved, but it confirmed a lot of the things which I was really thinking, which I think I'd been taught when I was at university. Anne Rand was writing at a time of communist excess, and at a time of the excessive dreams of politicians in many parts of the world, including the United States, that government could, by making a decision or spending some money, create a better life. And she was writing at a time when people everywhere, I believe, had much more faith in what government could achieve than is in fact the case. And so, from her experience, she saw that a lot of people were doing the wrong thing, the government was too large, it was too intrusive, and she was writing against it, very clearly, making very sharp points.
Malcolm, it seems an extraordinary influence on someone who struggled so hard to become a prime minister, and who, in fact, ran a very strong centralist government.
Well, you know, I don't know how much she knew about Australian affairs, but on the only occasion I met Ayn Rand at the White House in President Ford's time, we had quite a long discussion, and she'd said that she wanted to meet me because I was the only head of government who had put into place her policies. And that makes, you know, we discussed a lot of the things that I was doing here, and policies relating to multiculturalism, all sorts of things, she didn't seem to have a problem with. But I had been saying in the middle 1970s, before President Reagan, before Mrs. Thatcher, that the government had got too intrusive, the government expenditure was far too high, and there had to be some hauling back. But the approach that I took was that all this had to be done within the framework of a compassionate world where government recognized its continuing obligations to try and create a fair or a just society.
Well, I want to come back to that issue of compassion, because that often seems to be the missing link to in the Rand philosophy. But Joan, let's look at her as a feminist. I know she wouldn't have described herself thus, but her ideas and female characters seem to have influenced the feminist movement in America.
Well, yes, I think so. I think one of the things that happened was that her heroines, particularly Dagny Taggart, was a picture of a self-reliant woman who was able to achieve not only equally, but to surpass the men surrounding her. And this was a kind of role model that did not exist in fiction at the time that she was writing. And so a number of the people who went into the feminist movement first began to feel that they were able to accomplish anything that they wanted to in life through reading Ayn Rand. Hillary Clinton recently said that she went through a period of...
But Hillary's had many influences, Joan, hasn't she?
Yes, it's true. But again, this is, a generational thing, that a number of people first got their image of being independent, achieving, and happy, with or without men in their lives, from Ayn Rand.
Leonard, where did she sit within mainstream American politics? Was she...
Can I just inject one...
Sure.
And that is, if she were here, and I know her well enough to say, she would be torn at this point as to whether to denounce in stronger terms feminism or compassion. Now that I have that on the record, go ahead.
Well, I'm glad you raised that, because I want to get on to the area of compassion. But if she was with us today, would she be closer to the Democrats or the Republicans, or despise both parties with equal vehemence?
The last. She would despise Democrats insofar as they are still liberal and for more government, but she would hate Republicans insofar as they try to found their philosophy on religion and on Christianity. And from that point of view, she was anathema to both sides. She was an atheist, which made the right hater, the so-called right, and she was a arch-capitalist, which made the left hate her, and she was a complete extremist, which made the middle hate her.
And, of course, she'd have no truck with the Dole's policies or attitudes, however equivocal they might be at the moment, on abortion.
Oh, no. In fact, she used abortion as a litmus test. She would not vote for a presidential candidate who was opposed to abortion on demand.
Okay, let's look at this question of compassion. When I listen to Leonard's description of Rand's philosophies, I have to go tick, 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 right down the column. I also despise mysticism, a lifelong atheist. I believe that reality exists outside human theories. But I have always found the the political outcome of her arguments quite chilling. Now, Malcolm, you don't hesitate to use the word compassion. Leonard echoes Rand's view in having contempt for it. Are you therefore some sort of dreadful revisionist, Malcolm, in your attitudes to Rand?
Well, I emphasized, I didn't think so, but I emphasized the time at which she was writing. And she needed, in my, you know, if her ideas were to gain currency, if she was to make a point, I believe she, you know, probably felt that she had to make it very sharply, very starkly, a total contrast.
Well, in effect, an ambit claim, Malcolm, that she was overstating the case.
Ambit claim. And if Ayn Rand had been faced with the reality of starving children in Somalia, and if she was going down the road with a cartload of food, I don't think she'd pass by on the other side. I really don't.
Do you think she would, Leonard?
Wouldn't go to Somalia for $1 million, and if she did, her primary and sole concern would be to get out of there, and she would consider it utterly depraved that Americans were sent there on a humanitarian mission. She would say, if you're concerned with starving children, do it as an individual. You get no moral credit. It's an option that you're entitled to if that's what you want to do with your time. But if your real concern is starvation, then instead of handouts, you should be concerned with freeing the productive people who are going to create the wealth that will make the entire world able to survive.
Joan, I seem to be presented here with two Rands. They're slightly different. It's like two interpretations of Hamlet. What do you think Rand would do in Somalia?
Well, oh my goodness, what Rand would do in Somalia, I agree with Leonard that this would not be a primary concern of hers. I think, though, that we must recognize that she always said that, you know, benevolence was a virtue.
Benevolence as distinct from compassion.
And benevolence as distinct from altruism. What she was concerned about was the moral philosophy that said that the highest thing people could do was to live for others. She viewed benevolence as giving to those who you consider of value out of your abundance, which is quite different.
Leonard, it seems to me that Ayn Rand, I'm sorry, I'm mispronouncing it, but I think many of us are, Ayn Rand, will be rather happy with Russia today, where it is sort of frontier capitalism. Do you think she'd be enjoying that?
No, I think she would be just as appalled at Russia today as under communism, because it's the same essential gang philosophy, only the gang is the mafia instead of the party. It's a criminally controlled society, partly by private criminals and partly by the government, which is in cahoots with the old bureaucracy. There is no capitalism whatever in Russia. If by that we mean a system of private property, I don't believe there's private property in Russia. And I've already on record as saying it's, to me, a matter of time and not even a decade before that country becomes a complete dictatorship again.
Malcolm, we see Ayn Rand standing apart. The individual is all important. How does that philosophy fit in with the giant corporation? If it's inimical to big government, how does Rand sit in with a multinational corporation, for example?
Who was that to, Philip?
That's to you, Malcolm. I mean, in other words, if she despises the bureaucratic structure, would she despise it as much in a major corporation as she does as she would in a government?
I need to say that I have to bow to our American friends in terms of any in-depth knowledge of Ayn Rand, because, you know, my knowledge of her, my meeting with her was just once, and so my knowledge of her is much, much less than theirs. I would have thought, making the individual supreme, you've got to oppose the concentration of power in the hands of the great and mighty corporations. Many of them are more powerful than governments. Many of them are totally without scruple. They don't enlarge the freedom of individuals. They limit the choice of individuals, I believe, in very serious ways. for consistency, I would have thought she'd have to oppose what's happened in the corporate world.
Leonard, would that be true? It seems to me that she might endorse, say, the energetic individualism of a Rupert Murdoch whilst despising the more amorphous corporation where leadership is diffuse.
Actually, as an institution, she was completely in favor of any form of group or cooperative activity that was voluntary, and she was in no sense opposed to corporations. She believed that they have to make a crucial distinction between economic power and political power. Economic power, acquired in a proper free society, is acquired through productive achievement and is no threat to anybody else's liberty or, contrary to Mr. Fraser, to his choices. Political power is the power possessed by a government in virtue of controlling the apparatus of coercion, in virtue of having police in jail cells.
But surely, Leonard, the power in one sector flows into power in the other. Certainly it would in your society.
Well, in what way? You can't use your money to hold a gun to someone's head in this country.
Joan, would you accept that?
Hello?
Joan, would you accept that simple view that the corporate power does not, in fact, lead to or, in fact, subsume political power?
Put that way, I would not agree with you, but there's a point that I think needs to be brought out in this discussion, and that is one of the points that Atlas Shrugged made as a book was that there's a crucial distinction between the corporation, which is innovative and totally independent, and the corporation that in some part exists through government handouts or government power or government subsidy. Now, many of the multinational corporations that Malcolm Fraser might dislike, I think, get at least some of their power through alliance with governments. And to the extent that they do, Ayn Rand would be very negative about them.
Malcolm, I understand that Alan Greenspan, the federal chairman of the Reserve, the Fed, and an ex-student of Ayn Rand, is one of the top followers in the U.S. Do you know of others in Australia? Do you know people who share your enthusiasm for Rand's writings?
I haven't really followed the Ayn Rand clubs, I think, which do in part exist in Australia also. It was...
One might suspect that Costello is a follower of Rand.
Well, I wouldn't know. I really wouldn't.
Yeah. I'm troubled by this, Malcolm, by the fact that I came to know about Rand through your enthusiasm for the writings. And I think many Australians first read Rand because they knew that you were reading Rand. But you do see a different person.
Oh, I do, yes. I come back to the point. If you're espousing a theory and a view in a world that is significantly communist, where you've seen the problems deriving from that, where you've seen the excesses of socialism, where governments tried to do too many things, she was trying to promote a very strong counterpoint of view. And also, as I believe, was trying to do that within a logically consistent framework. But then I agreed with it, because to the extent that I did not believe that government can solve all problems.
Well, you took out of her writings what was useful to you, I guess. Now, Leonard, I understand that there's still 500,000 copies of her book sold each year. Is that a domestic U.S. figure or a global figure?
No, that's paperbacks in the United States. That's excluding hardcovers here and editions around the world.
And I understand the books are about to be recycled in Hollywood, and that there are over 100 university campus clubs studying her work.
That count. I know that it's in double digits, but I don't know. They come and go. There is a movie of Atlas Shrugged in process right now, and there's a documentary on Ayn Rand's life that was just entered in the Telluride Festival. Has that come down to us?
No, not yet, Leonard, but it seems, therefore, it's not so much a revival of Rand as... but she's never really been away.
No, absolutely true. I continuously hear of celebrities in this country that are interested in her, and prices that her things go for at auction are astronomical, like an ashtray.
Look, up there with Jackie Onassis, is she?
Your pardon?
Up there with Jackie Onassis in the memorabilia department.
Not that high, but as I say, an ashtray goes for $5,000-$10,000.
Well, Leonard, tell me this. Is Malcolm right to suggest that many of her more extreme positions on, say, welfare were ambit claims, were overstatements for dramatic purpose?
Absolutely not, with all due respect to Mr. Fraser. Ayn Rand never exaggerated for emphasis, and I, following her, would defend any one of her formulations as being a modest statement of the literal truth.
And Joan, you share that view.
Well, I would perhaps modify it in this way, that I think that she did not feel that her task was to discuss the political steps by which one got from the present situation to the totally free situation which she was trying to present in her novels. And so a great deal of the time when people would say, well, how do you abolish welfare, what do you do, or what would you do about taxes? She would say, well, these are details which people will work out. So that was not part of her interest, and I think one of the problems that those of us who believe in laissez-faire capitalism have facing us is precisely this question of how do you get from here to there. And
well, exactly. How does America possibly get from here to there, given its profound social problems as of this date in the latter part of 1996?
Well, I think that there's a possibility, although I'm not terribly sanguine about the possibility because bureaucrats tend to perpetuate themselves, but there is a possibility that the fact that we have 50 state governments may come up with some interesting solutions, that there may in fact now be a period of experimentation in trying to move things into the private sector that will be useful and point us the way to go.
Leonard, I understand that when the Library of Congress did a survey looking at what books had most changed people's lives, Atlas Shrugged came out on top.
No, second.
What was first?
The Bible.
What, people still reading that in America, are they? How quaint.
Some people apparently are. It's all Republicans, I think.
Well, you see, that's the thing about the woman. She must be anathema to the majority of practicing Republicans these days because of her energetic atheism.
Well, that's exactly why no one can classify her, because she's a passionately pro-individualistic atheist, and there's no such thing. I mean, except her followers in the United States.
Do people of the left make the sign of the cross and wear cloves of garlic when they discuss Rand? They certainly do in Australia.
Well, a lot of them don't discuss her, in my judgment, because they have absolutely no answer to what she says. It's easier just to blanket her with silence.
Joan, what are your fellow feminists, if that's not an oxymoron, to say about Rand?
Well, of course, feminism is a very, very diverse movement, and within it you have people of a lot of different orientations. I am particularly interested in that part of feminism which is from the classical liberal tradition, which has to do with with individualism and and equal rights for women. Those feminists are generally have had a positive experience with Rand's books. I don't know that they are really thinking about her in the context of today, but they remember the role model experience that they had, and they feel very positive about it.
Malcolm, I can see why you would have found Rand valuable in terms of her attitudes to big government. Let's go back to the other areas of her beliefs that that Leonard defined for us. Do you share with her a hostility to mysticism? I never thought about this aspect of your life. Are you, in fact, an atheist?
No, I'm not. but what I am, maybe I'm not too sure.
Well, you better find out, Malcolm. You're rushing towards the end of your life when you've got to make these decisions. Because it suddenly occurred to me, you would have been probably the first atheist in the lodge, wouldn't you? Or the first professed one.
Yeah, I would have.
Well, of course, Leonard, that precludes any follower of Rand getting the White House, because I can't imagine Americans electing an atheist as president.
Well, that is not a... She does not consider that an important part of her view. The important is the positive. She rejects not only God, but many, many different versions, from poltergeists to gremlins. From her point of view, what counts is what are you for. But I grant you, she would never be elected. First of all, she was born in Russia, so she's not...
No, she's not. She can't be a candidate, can she?
But I don't think anybody can get elected with decent views in today's philosophic state of the world. First, you need a philosophic revolution, and after that, saving the world will be easy. But without it, it's hopeless.
Leonard, is it an apocryphal story that she had a dollar sign on her coffin?
It's true, but it wasn't by her doing. And in fact, it was more or less by mine, in the sense...
Leonard, you had it put there.
No, I didn't, but I allowed it to be wheeled in. Some florist sent it at the behest of a fan, and it was a gigantic 6-foot dollar sign, and I wasn't too secure in my...